Hello and welcome to Wise Women, The Vicar and the Witch. I'm Maggie Whitehouse and I'm the Vicar.
And I'm Susie Crockford and I'm the Witch. We are perceived, perhaps, as being on opposite ends of a spectrum, but we're friends and we see the common threads of our different experience of the sacred. So please join us as we discuss
life, the universe and everything.
So, Maggie, last time we were speaking, I asked you, why is it, in the face of so much evidence to the contrary of your religion being populated with lovely people, for example, you still went back to it and were, in your words, stubbornly determined to heal it from within? I'm not phrasing myself very well at the moment, but I find it extraordinary that somebody who was literally told in one of the most horrendous moments of her life, on your husband's deathbed, you were given so little compassion and so little understanding, and yet you turned round and you kind of went into the belly of the beast, if you see what I mean. And I would really, really love to understand why.
Oh, well, I expect there's more than one reason. It's always the same, isn't it? It's a multitude of things. To start with, I was really angry. And I'd lived in a family where anger wasn't allowed. Mm. So it got suppressed, but of course it came out. I mean, in bereavement, you are angry quite frequently. And Henry died at a time when the United Kingdom was involved in a war. So the people who died in the war were being honoured all over the news, which sort of rubbed it in even more. That private deaths, I was reading somewhere today on social media, a friend was saying, why aren't the dead from the virus honoured on TV with photographs? And part of me was going, gee whiz, no, I don't think I want that. But I went and said, well, I can see what you're getting at, because when Henry died, I found it hard that it was a private grief, but I'd rather have people surviving who are honoured, because that gives hope. And in a way, that's kind of relevant, because I thought at some point that if I went into this and healed it, I would be able to help others, because I wasn't going to be the only one. More and more people, this was, Henry died in 1990, and gay folk weren't as accepted then as they are now, and trans people certainly weren't accepted, and there was so much still within the groaning death of Orthodox Christianity, which is what is happening. We've got fundamentalists or we've got mystics really now. The rest of the churches are empty, and fundamentalists are the ones who hold the letter of the law. So why did I do that? Well, first of all, I went into the New Age, because healing was the one thing that had helped Henry when he was sick. I'd always been told I'd had healing hands by the people I worked with in television. They'd asked me to give them a shoulder massage, for example, and they'd say, oh, you have healing hands. And I asked Henry whether he would consider healing, because we had a terminal diagnosis, and although we tried diet, it was too late for him. It did stop the cancer, but it wasn't turning it, because he wasn't going to change his emotional patterning. So I went into the New Age and learned healing, because I thought, I will give healing to people with cancer. And this is one of these things which you do it to make you feel better, to make other people better, to make you feel better. Mm-hmm. Which is the first route. It's not the ultimate route of healing. Mm. You do the healing because the planet needs it and it's the right thing to do, not to make you feel better. We've already said, you don't do the healing, it's channeled. But I did it. I went into the New Age. I became quite a proficient healer. I started a holistic magazine with my partner at the time, who was Jewish. And I went to this lady who was quite convinced that she was a reincarnation of Eve and the Virgin Mary. A completely mad person I was sent to be my mentor when I was training in healing. So I was realising that there was a lot wrong in the New Age too. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean to be rude about it, but I don't think this woman was a reincarnation of the Virgin Mary. I could be wrong.
Yeah.
Willing to be wrong on that one, but I thought it was probably a little unlikely. And there was one other thing as well, which was that when I went into the New Age, I got broke. I couldn't earn.
Oh.
And I noticed that a lot of people got broke and couldn't earn. and money was a real issue.
Mm.
And I sort of traced that back to Christianity, because Judaism doesn't have problems with money.
Mm.
But Christianity does. And that interested me, because I thought, maybe I'm broke because of something in Christianity, because I'm taught that Jesus was poor.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm now becoming a healer, not like Jesus, but like Jesus. Jesus told all the disciples and everybody who followed him to go out and heal. And suddenly I wasn't earning. And he'd also told them to go out without purses to manifest from the land. So I thought, well, I'll start studying prosperity consciousness. But it came back again and again to all this stuff in Christianity about Jesus was poor, which neatly forgets the fact that in Matthew he's visited by three astrologer priests who brought him gold, frankincense and myrrh, which basically made his family millionaires in those days. They probably had to spend it all going down into Egypt as refugees. But there were so many stories in there, and I thought, what's all this about? So when I started, I thought I'd study New Testament Greek so I could read the Gospels and discover for myself what was actually going on in them.
Mm.
And I started off really with St. Paul's thing, which is quoted so often, which is money is the root of all evil, which then goes back to the love of money is the root of all evil, which is a better translation. But if you go into it in the Greek, and he would have written in Greek, he was or got a scribe to write in Greek, so it probably was the first language, though we do know a lot of his work is edited. And the translation actually says, apart from having enough, and the two words that describe enough actually mean your home without and all your bills paid, enough clothing, enough food, enough coverings, enough ornaments, and enough to go to Jerusalem four times a year for the festivals. Don't seek after money for its own sake, because some who have done that have lost the connection to their soul. For avarice, which is obsession with money, is a root of all the crap in the world. It's not evil, it's crap. Kakos. And I just thought, whoa, that's different.
Yeah.
That's what he wrote.
That's what the beautiful idea of sufficient, having sufficient.
Exactly.
Is,
exactly, which is one of the things we're learning in lockdown. Yeah, or I hope we are.
I hope, yes.
Is to have what we need. And what we needed to start with was loo roll and flour and pasta and beans, apparently. But flour is interesting because you can see that people are starting to make bread.
Mm.
And there's all this stuff about sourdough, which I'm a total failure after all this time. Still a total failure, but never mind. So that was it. That was the leaven in Jesus' words. That was me saying, my God, that's magical.
Mm.
But I've been taught that the wanting money is the root of all evil, and it never says that at all. And the obsession over money, the avarice, means obsession over whether you've got it or not. So most people with a poverty consciousness are obsessed with money. And they're the ones he's talking about, just as much as your boss of Amazon or whatever that is. People are saying, he's going to be a trillionaire. And I'm going, great, good for him. He's got a prosperity consciousness. I can earn from that. He's not taking away from me. But a poverty consciousness assumes that the other is taking away from you. So I started studying prosperity consciousness with people like Ernest Holmes and Catherine Ponder, all the Unity churches, the religious science churches, the ones that sort of bordered between the New Age and Christianity. And alongside of that, this is a very long story, I'm afraid, alongside of that, my Jewish partner got thrown out by my teacher of healing because he didn't quite believe that she was the Virgin Mary. Dear, oh dear, but she said...
Oh dear.
She sent him down to London. We were living in Birmingham at the time, to a chap called Warren Kenson, who writes books under his Hebrew name is Zeb Ben Shimon Halevi, who teaches Jewish mysticism. It's called Kabbalah because that means receive. It's nothing to do with the Kabbalah Center. He's a Sephardi Jew who taught the tradition that was taught in the time when the Moors ruled Spain, when Christians, Jews, and Muslims were allowed to study together. And the mystics worked together. And Jonathan went down to study with Warren. He went to a couple of workshops and then was invited to go down to the Thursday evening group.
Mm.
And he would drive down from Birmingham to London, which was 2.5 hours either direction for a one-hour webinar. There you are, I'm getting so used to working on the internet now. In-person meeting. And he would tell me about it. And I thought, this sounds really interesting. Because this is what Jesus would have learned, the oral tradition. Because the point of Kabbalah is it must update for every generation. Otherwise it's dead. And all faiths are meant to update for every generation because every generation learns and is at a different level. And I said, oh, can I go? And Jonathan said, no, no, you can't. You've got to go to the workshops. You've got to be invited. And being me, I rang Warren Kenton up and said, hello, I'm Jonathan's wife. May I? And he said, yes, of course, all partners are welcome. So I started going down there and studying this stuff. And I remember Warren saying very quickly at the beginning, he said, in the end, you have to choose a tradition. You have to choose one tradition to commit to. I'm not saying he was right, but it really struck me. Mm-hmm. Because otherwise, you're never going to have that commitment of that discipline of loving the divine. You're always going to have excuses to go another way, get a bit more information here, a bit more there.
Yeah, I think I agree
that
with
and the other. Yeah. And I remember sitting there in that wonderful room covered in walls, pictures and images and all sorts of incredible things and thinking, oh, well, I'll be a healer with an interest in Kabbalah. If you want to make God laugh, tell him your plans. And from then on, there was a bit of a battle because I became utterly fascinated in equating this Jewish mystical tradition I was learning with the teachings of Jesus. And I started realising that there was no need for Jesus to go to India, which people say he did. No need for him to go to Alexandria. No need for him to do anything in the missing years apart from get married, settle down, have a family and be widowed, because women lived a very short length of time in those days. And because it was all there. And because all this magical stuff was all there, I just got this calling to start digging it out. So that's what I did. And I had fights with my teacher simply because I was a woman and I wasn't Jewish.
Yeah.
And although he'd accepted me as the wife of a Jewish man, it was quite obvious that I wanted to be a teacher. I wanted to lift this tradition. I wanted to take it into the feminine. And there were certain spats about that. And I said I also wanted to take it into Christianity. And there was a seminal moment on the Sea of Galilee because he used to run pilgrimages to places where the teachers taught in the 11th, 12th century and all the way back to pre-Jesus times. And we went to Israel on a very Jewish journey. And I think the real two turning points there, first was on the Sea of Galilee. We went out in one of the boats and you get fed St. Peter's fish on the boat. It's a tourist thing. Mm-hmm. But after we'd had our fish, Warren started teaching on the boat, which was just like it would have been.
Yeah.
And I put my hand up and I said to him, does the Lord's Prayer fit on the Tree of Life? And he said, yes, but that's your job. So sitting on the Sea of Galilee, having my teacher say, that's your job, went in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there was another point on that trip where you go to the Western Wall and you place a prayer in the wall. It's one of the things that you do. You write on a piece of paper your prayer and you put it in the wall. And the Kabbalist prayer is to help God behold God, mm-hmm. to be a mirror of the divine. And I put two prayers in there, one of which couldn't be resolved without ending the marriage, so God ended the marriage. That's another story. But the other one was to help God behold God. Mm-hmm. Now, on that pilgrimage, because it was a Jewish one, there was a lot of segregation in the synagogues and at the tombs, because that's the way it is in Orthodox Judaism. Mm-hmm. And the teacher was male, so the women were going, they started this susurration. I love that word. We're not having the fun. Look at this, it's either dirty and their side's probably wonderful. And I kept thinking, well, why don't you do something? Why don't we do something? But I couldn't because I wasn't Jewish, mm-hmm. and I was quite new to the group and I was scared. And at the Western Wall, there was this huge feminine susurration because all the men got on their copple, whatever, you know, the things on their heads. I apologise, Jewish friends, and my brain's gone fried because I'm talking a lot. And some of them had their prayer shawls, and they were with the teacher, and the women were just sort of milling around while I put my thing in the wall. And then we went back to the hotel that night, and I started feeling ill, which was really not usual for me. Mm-hmm. And I went to the bath, which is my place of sacred healing, lay in the bath, and this voice just said in my head, same one as with the shark, the barracuda, said, "Why didn't you speak, Maggie?" And I said, "Because I'm not good enough." And there was this sigh.
Yes, I bet.
And the voice said, "You know something, Maggie? You're absolutely right. You're not good enough, and you probably never will be good enough. But you are the only one who was listening, and we have to work with the ones who are listening."
Love it.
I know, it was so unexpected. It just sort of blew my brain open.
Yeah.
Okay. And then I got this sort of feeling, well, another time will you speak up? Well, it was fairly easy to say yes, because I wasn't going to be tested, was I? I said, okay, I promise, and next time I'll speak up. Next morning we go up to the Dome of the Rock before we're heading off to Qumran. It was shut, inexplicably. They weren't going to open it for another half hour. So Warren said, "Oh, we'll go back down to the Western Wall." So we trailed down to the Western Wall for another half hour. And the whole way down, I was going, "You bastard, you bastard, bastard." And when I got there, I'd made a promise. So I just said to the women, "Let's get in the circle and pray together." That's all I had to do. Mm. And yet 25 years, I was at a meeting with the same group, having been expelled several times and readmitted and expelled and readmitted because I'm a girl and I'm a Christian and all that. And one of them said, we were talking about the memories of the teaching, one of them said the most important time for her was 25 years ago when the women had spontaneously got into a circle and prayed at the Western Wall. And it was, there was no need for her to even remember it was me. That was nothing to do with it at all. She remembered it.
Yeah.
And how significant that was. And straight after that, after the Western Wall thing, we went to Qumran, and I was standing looking out over the rocks to where the scrolls were found, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I was with the daughter of a very famous British television star who was part of that group as well. And she turned to me and said, "There's a woman out there waving. She's carrying two scrolls." And I thought she meant literally, and then I realised she was using her third eye. I could see nothing. Mm. And then she stood there and she hesitated for a moment. She turned, she looked at me and she said, "She's waving at you," and walked away. And as soon as she said that, the first two chapters of the Book of Deborah, my first novel, fell into my head. Wow. And I had to run back to the coach and write them down. And they were a novel about an orphaned girl who's raised in the Holy Family and grows up next to Jesus. And I always crack up because it's a beautiful novel because, is it channeled? I don't know. I wrote it, but the ideas came through. And in fact, when I tried to change the plot, I got disk boot failure on my computer. And it found an agent, it found a publisher, and it went out. And it didn't do terribly well because The Red Tent by Anita Diamond came out at the same time, and that was the one that took off. But it's still there, and it's still published. And I still get letters from women all over the world saying, "Thank you." Mm. Because it was just about a little girl who was hurt and wounded, which I was, who grew up next to Jesus. And as I wrote it, I am crying, by the way, not laughing. People don't necessarily know when it's recorded. Because it can sound like laughing. And I healed myself by writing that book. So I owe all of that a huge debt of healing. So how could I not?
Yeah.
When ordination came to find me via my bishop, and I did fight it. I did fight it. It said, "No, go inside the box. Go inside this wounded tradition and take what you've got. And it will be enough."
Mm.
And that's taken 18 minutes and 55 seconds.
Oh, my goodness. Well, it's a hell of a story. I'm sorry, I'm overwhelmed by the desire to join you in crying. I find the whole story really, really moving. And I'm also, there's a little bit of me that, here, there's you, and your journey led you to be the woman who wears a beautiful rainbow shirt and a dog collar and uses the word Jesus a lot. And here's me, raised in, you know, a very, very Roman Catholic family, who I love dearly, so much, have so much respect for. And yet, just from being the tiniest bean, was so sure to the core of my bones that what they were telling me was not the whole truth.
Absolutely. And not, and it isn't.
No. But, and that it feels like the most extraordinary circle. I mean, not to put too much kind of, you know, woo onto you and I and this podcast, but that two women of a kind of, you know, similar persuasion, similar years of life, similar, I see us as being quite, you know, it's not a big surprise.
We could have gone to the same school.
We could have gone to the same school. There's a whole other story.
Yes, isn't there, Jeff?
Let's not go there. You know, we might easily be seen to be in many regards, certainly just as women, obvious candidates for friendship. And yet, if you look at the kind of edges of what we might be supposed to believe, then we are poles apart. And yet, here we are having these amazing conversations. And it makes me feel again so strongly the massive need in our society to get over ourselves as regard to my story is better than your story, and start making a new story. I'm absolutely committed to the idea that words are spells, and that, you know, yes, your Book of Deborah will be out there in the world offering people healing, just as, you know, the Bible does and as lots of other books do. But it feels so much like this is the time, now is the day, this is the moment where we need to begin to tell a story that's about all of us in as humans, as ensouled divine, as the divine witnessing the divine, like they ask for at the wall, as animal bodies, acknowledging that we are, you know, material creations of Gaia or whoever, but that those things are, they unite us, they're so make us the same. And that, wouldn't it be amazing if we could come up with a story that was all about how the same we are? If ever there was a moment when we are being shown that this is one united world, it is surely the moment of a pandemic. Pan. Everything. That marvellous trickster God. He who puts the eros in the whole of the green world. He is pandemic, pandemonium, panic. And I'm not saying he's a bad guy at all, far from it. but that, you know, that's it. We've got a one world story now. One little bug has infected us all, or not. One little bug has meant that we've all gone, okay, no planes, no boats, no running outside for you. All of us, all over the world. So surely now is the moment when all of us, all over the world, can go, okay, I agree. I am a divine being in an animal body on an animate planet. Now let's look after it.
Well, you're talking from the soul. And the majority of us have never even learnt that we have a soul. Even in churches, you're really not taught about your soul. You're taught about your ego, which is my tribe, your tribe. I hope you're right. I really, really hope you're right. And I think the longer this goes on, the more chance we have, because more and more people are observing the beauties of nature. More and more people are finding what is treasure. My mother on the phone this morning said, I want to see a rainbow again.
Oh, where does she live?
Birmingham.
Ah, okay.
The view from her house, she's got a lovely garden, but there's lots of trees at the back of her garden. She's got the most perfect place for being a 92-year-old in a pandemic, that's in social isolation. And she's got plenty of friends, thank goodness, looking after her. But that touched me much more than the, oh God, I may never see you again, I may die before I see you again stuff, which could happen anyway because I could get run over by a bus. They are still running. But, you know, I would want to see a rainbow again. And I just thought, yeah, a rainbow, yes. How precious and how treasured that is. And maybe, I mean, she says to me quite often, I don't know why I haven't died. And why haven't I died? I want to die. I want to go. I'm ready to go. She's much more Orthodox Christian than me, that we have been able to talk about stuff like reincarnation. And her church has been so good and kind to her since this. So that's really good. Nice to know. But I said to her very gently, well, generally we die when we've done all we came to do this time. And she said, well, I can't do anything. I can't get out. I can't do that. And I just sort of said, well, it might be an idea to look at a bit of forgiveness, perhaps. And just left it at that. And that's all I can say, because she's got huge, huge issues around her mother. And about my father as well, possibly quite justifiably about my father. But there you go. It's if we can just get closer to nature because of this and see how beautiful it is, absolutely. I think we have a problem with the fundamentalism of all aspects, because fundamentalism is kindergarten religion for people who will not investigate for themselves. And you can see this with the conspiracy theories at the moment. I'm not saying the conspiracy theories are all untrue. They're not. They're Lucific truths. A Lucific truth has a grain of truth that is manipulated to cause fear. And, you know, the keeping of people afraid gives you power.
Totally.
And that's an egoic thing as well. And the joy of a faith, like hopefully like yours and like mine, is the lessening of fear.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to die. I think I have things to do. But to die will be an awfully great adventure.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly how I see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't want to. I'm not ready to. But I'm fully prepared to, and in total and utter of acceptance of the fact that I absolutely, definitely am going to, which isn't even something you could say for everyone, which I find just extraordinary. You know, as a culture, we are so terrified of even talking about it.
Yes, it's got to be shut away.
Yeah.
It's wrong. It's not allowed.
It's seen as a failure.
Yeah.
As, you know, much like getting ill is in some extraordinary sense seen as a failure. It's a failure and an insult when death comes.
You know? Oh, I do know when I had the diagnosis of cancer, I had to deal with shame. Because I was a minister and a healer, I should have done better.
That reminds me of, so, we've just been talking about death. Previously, I said that I would recommend a book, and we've forgotten to do all our book recommendations, but I've remembered who I was talking
about.
Oh,
well done, that woman. I was going to mention it to you.
The amazing book on death is called Die Wise by Stephen Jenkinson. Okay. The brilliant book about shame is called Burning Woman by Lucy Pierce. And just while I'm here recommending books, I would love for any and every listener, no matter their age and no matter their gender, to please read a book by Barbara J. Walker, but maybe it's Barbara K. Walker. I know I get it wrong, and now I've been wrong so many times I can't remember which one's right. And the book is called Crone, and it's got a front cover that makes you wonder if her publisher actually didn't ever want anyone to ever buy the book, because it's got the face of a woman who is clearly very, very, very old, and she has many, many wrinkles. And you look at the book, and certainly, you know, I was recommended this book a good, probably 10 years before I read it, because I dutifully went out and got it. You know, I trusted the woman who recommended it to me. Excellent. Saw the cover and just thought, whoa, I'm not ready for that.
But that's sensible. You shouldn't read it until you're ready. No shoulds, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I do know what you mean. Yeah. But it's not. Although it is absolutely a book about the crone, about becoming a crone, about the crone years, it's also a book about crone in the greatest sense of the word, and that astonishingly powerful crone energy that doesn't give any rats behinds about what the majority think. And so, therefore, is incredibly powerful, and it is a power of a feminine who will not kowtow to the broken patriarchy and to the paradigm of accumulation and acquisition and all the rest of it. And it is, I just can't recommend it highly enough. So please just avert your gaze from the front cover and read it anyway. It's amazing.
And while we're saying stuff, I did teach prosperity consciousness for a long time and actually trained some people to teach it as well. But you teach what you most need to learn, and I don't teach it anymore. But during the pandemic, I have put up a 10-part webinar series I did on 10 Steps to Prosperity, which is all about changing your prosperity consciousness, changing the consciousness that expects lack or works is too ashamed to get wealthy, and it talks about the Christian stuff as well. That is entirely free now and will remain free. Great. So I'll put the link below the podcast stuff. So if you are struggling financially, please go get it. Got me out of £50,000 worth of debt, so I think it probably works.
I think it might work, yes.
And well, one of the things on that too is these misunderstandings that drive me crazy, but it's my job to bring them up to the light, is the biblical system of tithing. And okay, I talk about this all the time, because churches will tell you you have to give 10% of your profit, your earnings, to the church or to charity, but mostly to the church. And that's really not what the Bible says. The Bible's really clear on tithing, and it's absolutely beautiful. You have to trawl through parts of the Hebrew Testament to get it, but when you find it, it's clear. It says money is excluding from tithing. It was all about produce, your increase. So if you had a you know, 10 lambs, one lamb. But tenth in those days meant one whole thing. So it could be an apple. And basically what it says is, give your first attention to the divine before all other things, in time and prosperity. And in those days, they used the tithe to pay the Levites or the priests because they didn't have salaries. But you could do whatever you liked. And I've tithed by putting, and I've actually, I do use tithing with money. I've put money out in the land for somebody else to find because I gave it to God. It doesn't matter who found it. It's my, I wish to give this to you. The night before my ordination, I put a £50 note on the little Knight's Chapel altar in Tewkesbury Abbey. No idea who found it. And it doesn't matter because it was my thank you, thank you, thank you for this. I did a sort of Knight's Vigil in the chapel, in the little Knight's Chapel there. It was absolutely glorious. It was the night before my ordination, and they suddenly started practicing the choir, practicing the prologue to St. Matthew Passion by Bach.
You know, so beautiful.
It was extraordinary. But the tithe is so, let's go with attention first, because once you get the attention right, everything else flows. First, attention to your connection with the divine. Second tithe was celebration. It's called the celebration tithe. It was to go to Jerusalem. It was go to have parties. And if you can't go on holiday to Jerusalem, you were told to spend it on a feast with strong drink.
Sounding more like my kind of thing.
Yeah. But think about that. So it's God, fun, and the third tithe, which was only given every third year, was charity. Because the teaching was, if you followed the first two, you didn't need charity. And anyway, in those days, they had a rule that 10% of all the crops were left in the fields for people to glean.
Yeah, you see, I mean, this is the kind of thing that has been completely forgotten, it seems to me, not just in Christianity, but kind of full stop.
Yeah.
And is a place that we so desperately need to get back to.
But I want to tell people that it's in the tradition that they've been raised in.
Yeah.
Not just the pagan tradition, which is how it can be discounted so easily.
Yeah. But and also that what I would like to say, just as a quick plug for something I really am so behind, as in really fully want to support, is that exactly that the practice of giving back to life, so to Gaia, the practice of supporting that which nurtures you, which tithing is, you know, in a world where the church was part of the kind of structure of society and support system of society, you were in a way helping to support the support, as it were, is to join Tree Sisters, and that Tree Sisters, if you haven't heard of it, is the most extraordinary, I guess it's a charity. It's just celebrating the fact that it's planted 10 million trees. So on the one hand, it's funding the reforestation of mainly the tropics, but a bunch of other places too, which is giving back to Gaia in a really good and beautiful way. And on the other hand, it is a website with a series of videos, teachings, interviews, you know, everything you can think of in support of re-empowering the feminine and specifically feminine nature-based leadership.
Wonderful. Please send me the link and I'll, again, I'll put all these links up this week.
Brilliant.
But that just finishes off beautifully with the fourth tithe, which was the sabbatical year. Every 7 years the land was rested.
Yay.
And all debt was forgiven. You know, you were honour bound if you took on a debt to try and repay it within 7 years, but if you couldn't, it was released.
What on earth happened? Those are four beautiful, beautiful things. How, when, why did they stop being a thing? I mean, I can answer why. When did they stop being a thing?
I don't know. I really don't know. But that's why I'm a minister.
That's such a perfect answer to my question. Thank you.